The young man seemed startled, then resigned. You are right. You have forged a water bond between us. I am called Turok. Now we must go.
Water bond?
Kain suppressed his questions and trailed after his companion. In his well-worn still suit, Turok scrambled over the rocks toward the vertical cliff. Kynes trudged beside fallen boulders, slipping on loose footing. Only as they approached did the planetologist notice a discontinuity in the strata, a seam that split the old uplifted rock, forming a fissure camouflaged by dust and muted colors. The Freeman slipped inside, penetrating the shadows with the speed of a desert lizard. Curious and anxious not to become lost, Kynes followed, moving quickly. He hoped he would get a chance to meet more of the Freeman and learn about them. He didn't waste time considering that Turok might be leading him into a trap. What would be the point? The young man could easily have killed him out in the open. Turok stopped in the cool shade, giving Kynes a moment to catch up. He pointed toward specific places on the wall near him. There, there, and there. Without waiting to see if his charge understood, the youth stepped in each indicated spot, near invisible handholds and footholds. The young man slithered up the cliff, and Kynes did his best to climb after. Turok seemed to be playing a game with him, testing him somehow. But the planetologist surprised him. He was no waterfat bureaucrat, no mere bumbler into places where he didn't belong. As a wanderer on some of the harshest worlds the Imperium had to offer, he was in good shape. Kynes kept pace with the youth, climbing up behind him, using the tips of his fingers to haul his body higher. Moments after the Freeman boy stopped and squatted on a narrow ledge, Kynes sat beside him, trying not to pant.
"Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth," Turok said. "Your filters are more efficient that way."
He nodded in faint admiration.
"I think you might make it all the way to the Siege."
"What's a Siege?" Kynes asked.
He vaguely recognized the ancient Jacobsa language, but had not studied archaeology or phonetics. He had always found it irrelevant to his scientific study.
"A secret place to retreat in safety. It's where my people live."
"You mean it's your home?"
"The desert is our home."
"I'm eager to talk with your people," Kynes said, then continued, unable to contain his enthusiasm.
"I've formed some opinions of this world and have developed a plan that might interest you, that might interest all the inhabitants of Arrakis."
"Dune," the Freeman youth said. "Only the Imperials and the Harkonnens call this place Arrakis."
"All right," Kynes said. "Dune, then."
Deep in the rocks ahead of them waited a grizzled old Freeman with only one eye, his useless left socket covered by a puckered prune of leathered eyelid. Naib of Red Wall Siege, Hynar had also lost two fingers in a Kris-knife duel in his younger days. But he had survived, and his opponents had not. Hynar had proved to be a stern but competent leader of his people. Over the years, his siege had prospered. The population had not decreased, and their hidden stockpiles of water grew with every cycle of the moons. In the infirmary cave, two old women tended foolish Stilgar, the injured youth who had been brought in by ground car only moments ago. The old women checked the medical dressing that had been applied by the outsider, and augmented it with some of their own medicinals. The crones conferred with each other, then both nodded at the siege leader.
"Stilgar will live, Hynar," one old woman said. "This would have been a mortal wound had it not been tended immediately. The stranger saved him."
"The stranger saved a careless fool," the Naib said, looking down at the young man on the cot.
For weeks, troublesome reports of a curious outsider had reached Hynar's ears.
Now the man, Pardat Kynes, was being led to the Siege by a different route, through rock passageways. The stranger's actions were mind-boggling. An imperial servant who killed Harkonnens? Amun, the Freeman youth who had brought bleeding Stilgar back through the Siege, waited anxiously beside his injured friend in the cave shadows. Einar turned his monocular gaze to the young man, letting the women continue to tend their patient.
"Why is it that Chorak brings an outsider to our Siege?"
"What were we to do, Einar?" Amun looked surprised. "I needed his vehicle to bring Stilgar here."
"You could have taken this man's ground car and all his possessions and given his water to the tribe," the Naib said, his voice low.
"We can still do that,"
one of the women rasped, "as soon as Chorak gets here with him."
"But the stranger fought and killed Harkonnens. We three would have died had he not arrived when he did," Amun insisted. "Is it not said that the enemy of my enemy is my friend?"
"I do not trust or even understand the loyalties of this one," Einar said, crossing his sinewy arms over his chest. "We know who he is, of course. The stranger comes from the Imperium, a planetologist, they say. He remains on Dune because the Harkonnens are forced to let him do his work. But this man Kynes answers only to the Emperor himself. If that, there are unanswered questions about him."
Wearily, Einar sat down on a stone bench carved in the side of the wall. A colorful tapestry of spun spice fibers hung across the cave opening, offering a limited sort of privacy. Siege inhabitants learned early that privacy was in the mind, not in the environment.
"I will speak with this Kynes and learn what he wants of us. Why he has defended three stupid and careless youths against an enemy he had no cause to make. Then I will take this matter to the Council of Elders and let them decide. We must make the choice that is best for the Siege."
Amun swallowed hard, recalling how valiantly the man Kynes had fought against the ruthless soldiers. But his fingers strayed to the pouch in his pocket, counting the water rings there, metal markers that tallied the accumulated wealth he had in the tribe. If the elders did decide to kill the planetologist after all, then he, Chorak, and Stilgar would divide the water treasure equally among them, along with the bounty from the 6 slain Harkonnens. When Chorak finally led him through the guarded openings, past a door seal, and into the Siege proper, Kynes saw the place as a cave of infinite wonders. The aromas were dense, rich, and redolent with humanity, smells of life, of a confined population, of manufacturing, cooking, carefully concealed wastes, and even chemically exploited death. In a detached way, he confirmed his suspicion that the Freeman youths had not stolen the Harkonnen corpses for some sort of superstitious mutilation, but for the water in their bodies. Otherwise, it would have gone to waste. Kynes had assumed that when he finally found a hidden Freeman settlement, it would be primitive, almost shameful in its lack of amenities. But here, in this walled-off grotto with side caves and lava tubes, and tunnels extending like a warren throughout the mountain, Kynes saw that the desert people lived in an austere yet comfortable style. Quarters rivaled anything Harkonnen functionaries enjoyed in the city of Carthag, and they were much more natural. As Kynes followed his young guide, he found his attention riveted on one fascinating sight after another. Luxurious woven carpets covered portions of the floor. Side rooms were strewn with cushions and low tables made of metal and polished stone. Articles of precious off-planet wood were few and seemingly ancient. A carved sandworm and a board game that he couldn't identify, its ornate pieces made of ivory or bone. Ancient machinery recirculated the Siege air, letting no breath of moisture escape. He smelled the sharp cinnamon sweetness of raw spice everywhere, like incense, barely masking the sour pungency of unwashed bodies packed into close quarters. He heard women talking, children's voices, and a baby crying, all with a hushed restraint. The freemen spoke among themselves, eyeing the stranger with suspicion as he passed, led by Turok. Some of the older ones flashed him wicked smiles that gave the planetologist some concern. Their skin looked tough and leathery, leached of all excess water. Every pair of eyes was a deep blue within blue. Finally, Turok raised a hand, palm outward, signaling Kynes to halt inside a large meeting hall, a natural vault within the mountain. The grotto had ample floor space for hundreds and hundreds to stand. Additional benches and balconies zigzagged up the sheer reddish walls. How many people live in this Siege? Kynes stared upward in the empty, echoing room to a high balcony, a speaking platform of some sort. After a moment, a proud old man stepped forward up there to look disdainfully down at the intruder. Kynes noted that the man had only one eye, and that he carried himself with the presence of a leader.
"This is Hynar," Turok whispered in his ear, "the Naib of Redwall Siege."
Raising a hand in greeting, Kynes called out, "I am pleased to meet the leader of this wondrous Freeman city." "What is it you want from us, Imperial man?" Hynar called down in a tone that was ruthless and demanding. His words rang like cold steel against the stone. Kynes drew a deep breath. He had been waiting for an opportunity such as this for many days. Why waste time? The longer that dreams remained mere dreams, the more difficult it was to mold them into reality. "My name is Pardut Kynes, planetologist to the Emperor. I have a vision, sir, a dream for you and your people. One I wish to share with all the freemen, if only you will listen to me." "Better to listen to the wind through a creosote bush than to waste time with the words of a fool," the Siege leader responded. His words had a ponderous weight, as if this were an old and recognizable saying among his people. Kynes stared back at the old man and quickly made up his own platitude, hoping to make an impression. "And if one refuses to listen to words of truth and hope, who then is the greater fool?" Young Turok gasped. From side passages, freeman onlookers stared wide-eyed at Kynes, amazed by this stranger who spoke so boldly to their Naib. Hynar's face became dark and stormy. He felt a sullenness permeate him, and he envisioned this upstart planetologist lying slain on the cave floor. He put his hand on the hilt of a kris knife at his waist. "Do you challenge my leadership?" Making up his mind, the Naib yanked the curve-bladed knife from its sheath and glowered down at Kynes. Kynes didn't flinch. "No, sir, I challenge your imagination. Are you brave enough to meet the task? Or are you too frightened to listen to what I have to say?" The Siege leader stood tense, holding his strange milky blade high as he stared down at the prisoner. Kynes simply smiled up at him, his expression open. "It's difficult to talk to you way up there, sir." Finally, Hynar chuckled, looked down at the bare blade in his hand. "A kris knife, once drawn, must never be sheathed without tasting blood." Then he quickly slashed its edge across his forearm, drawing a thin red line that coagulated within seconds. Kynes' eyes glittered with excitement, reflecting the light cast by the clusters of glow globes that floated in the large meeting chamber. "Very well, planetologist. You may talk until the breath flows out of your lungs. With your fate undecided, you will remain here in the Siege until the Council of Elders deliberates over what must be done with you. But you'll listen to me first." Kynes nodded with utter confidence.
Einar turned, took a step away from the high balcony, and spoke again over his shoulder.
"You are a strange man, Pardot Kynes. An imperial servant and a guest of Harkonnen's. By definition, you are our enemy. But you have killed Harkonnen's as well. What a quandary you present for us."
The Siege leader made quick gestures and barked commands, ordering a small but comfortable room to be prepared for the tall and curious planetologist, who would be their prisoner as well as their guest. And Einar thought, as he strode away, "Any man who would speak words of hope to the Freeman after our many generations of suffering and wandering is either confused or a very brave man indeed." My father had only one real friend, I think. That was Count Hasimir Fenring, the genetic eunuch and one of the deadliest fighters in the Imperium. From In My Father's House by the Princess Irulan. Even from the highest darkened chamber of the Imperial Observatory, the pastel glow of the opulence-choked capital drowned out the stars over Kaitain. Built centuries earlier by the enlightened Padishah Emperor Hasik Corino III, the observatory had been used little by his recent heirs, at least not for its intended purpose of studying the mysteries of the universe. Crown Prince Shaddam paced across the cold, burnished metal floor as Fenring fiddled with the controls of a high-powered starscope. The genetic eunuch hummed to himself, making unpleasant, insipid sounds. "Would you please stop those noises?" Shaddam said. "Just focus the damned lenses." Fenring continued to hum, only fractionally quieter now. "The oils must be in precise balance. You would rather have the starscope perfect than fast." Shaddam huffed. "You didn't ask my preference." "I decided for you." He stood back from the starscope's calibrated phased optics and bowed with an annoyingly formal gesture. "My Lord Prince, I present to you an image from orbit. See it with your own eyes." Shaddam squinted into the eyepiece pickups until a shape became startlingly clear, soaring silently in the distance. The image shifted between brittle resolution and murky ripples caused by atmospheric distortion. The mammoth highliner was the size of an asteroid, hanging over Kaitain and waiting to be met by a flotilla of small ships from the surface. A tiny movement caught his eye, and Shaddam spotted the yellow-white flickers of engines as frigates rose from Kaitain bearing diplomats and emissaries, followed by transports carrying artifacts and cargo from the Imperial capital world. The frigates themselves were immense, flanked by cadres of smaller ships, but the curve of the highliner's hull dwarfed everything. At the same time, other ships departed from the highliner hold and descended toward the capital city. "Delegation parties," Shaddam said. "They've brought tributes to my father."
"Taxes, actually, not tributes," Fenring pointed out.
"Same thing in an old-fashioned sense, of course. Elrood is still their emperor." The Crown Prince scowled at him. "But for how much longer? Is your damned Chomurki going to take decades?" Shaddam fought to keep his voice low, although subsonic white noise generators supposedly distorted their speech to foil any listening devices. "Couldn't you find a different poison? A faster one? This waiting is maddening. How much time has passed anyway? It seems like a year since I've slept well."
"You mean we should have been more overt about the murder?" "Not advisable."
Fenring took his station back at the starscope, adjusting the automated trackers to follow the highliner along its orbit.
"Be patient, my Lord Prince. Until I suggested this plan, you were content to wait for decades. What does a year or two matter compared with the length of your eventual reign?"
Shaddam nudged Fenring away from the eyepieces so he wouldn't have to look at his fellow conspirator.
Now that we've finally set the wheels in motion, I'm impatient for my father to die. Don't give me time to brood about it and regret my decision. I'll suffocate until I can ascend the Golden Lion throne. I was destined to lead Hasimir, but some have been whispering that I'll never get the opportunity. It makes me afraid to marry and father any children. If he expected Fenring to attempt to convince him otherwise, the other man disappointed him with his silence. Fenring spoke again after a few moments. "Ki is slow poison by design. We have worked long and hard to establish our plan, and your impatience can only cause damage and increase risk. A more sudden act would certainly create suspicion in the Landsraad. They would seize upon any wedge, any scandal, to weaken your position."
"But I am the heir to House Carino," Shaddam said, lowering his voice to a throaty whisper. "How can they question my right?"
"And you come to the imperial throne bearing all the associated baggage, all the obligations, past antagonisms and prejudices. Don't fool yourself, my friend. The Emperor is merely one sizable force among many that make up the delicate fabric of our Imperium. If all the houses banded together against us, even your father's mighty Sardaukar legions might not be able to hold out. No one dares risk it. When I'm on the throne, I intend to strengthen the Emperorship, add some real teeth to the title." Shaddam stood away from the starscope. Fenring shook his head with exaggerated sadness. "I'd be willing to wager a cargo hold full of the highest quality whale fur that most of your predecessors have vowed the same thing to their advisers ever since the Great Revolt." He drew a deep breath, narrowing his large dark eyes. "Even if the Inki works as planned, you have at least another year to wait. So calm yourself. Take comfort in the increased symptoms of aging we've seen in your father. Encourage him to drink more spice beer." Miffed, Shaddam turned back to the phased optics and studied the hull patterns along the belly of the Highliner, the mark of Ixion construction yards, the cartouche of the Spacing Guild. The hold was crowded with fleets of frigates from various houses, shipments assigned to Choam, and precious records earmarked for library archives on Wallach 9. "By the way, someone of interest is aboard that Highliner," Fenring said.
"Oh?"
Fenring crossed his arms over his narrow chest. "A person who appears to be a simple seller of pundi rice and chikarba root on his way to a Tleilaxu way station. He's bearing your message for the Tleilaxu masters, your proposal to meet with them and discuss covert imperial funding of a large-scale project that will produce a substitute for the spice melange."
"My proposal? I made no such proposal."
Revulsion flickered across Shaddam's face.
You did, my lord prince. The possibility of using unorthodox Tleilaxu means to develop a synthetic spice. What a good idea you had. Show your father how smart you are."
"Don't place the blame on me, Hasimir. It was your idea."
"You don't want the credit?"
"Not in the least." Fenring raised his eyebrows.
"You are serious about breaking the Arrakis bottleneck and setting up the Imperial House with a private, unlimited source of melange, aren't you?"
Shaddam glowered. "Of course I'm serious."
"Then we will bring a Tleilaxu master here in secret to present his proposal to the Emperor. We'll soon see how far old Elrud is willing to go."
Blindness can take many forms other than the inability to see. Fanatics are often blinded in their thoughts. Leaders are often blinded in their hearts. The Orange Catholic Bible. For months, Leto had stayed in the underground city of Verniae as the honored guest of Ix. By now, he had become comfortable with the strangeness of his new surroundings, with the routine, and with self-confident Ixion security, comfortable enough to grow careless. Prince Romber was a chronic late sleeper,
while Leto was the opposite, an early riser like the fishermen on Caladan. The Atreides heir wandered the upper stalactite buildings alone, going to observation windows and peeking in on manufacturing design procedures or fabrication lines. He learned how to use the transit systems and discovered that his bioscram card from Earl Vernius opened many doors for him. Leto gleaned more from his wanderings and his voracious curiosity than he did from instructional meetings hosted by various tutors. Remembering his father's admonishment to learn from everything, he took the self-guiding lift tubes. When none were available, he grew accustomed to using walkways, cargo lifts, or even ladders to go from one level to another. One morning, after awakening refreshed and restless, Leto went to one of the upper atriums and stepped out onto an observation balcony. Even sealed underground, the caverns of Ix were so vast that they had their own air currents and wind patterns, though it was a far cry from the castle towers and windy cliffsides of his home. He took a deep breath, filling his lungs to capacity, but the air here always smelled of rock dust. Maybe it was just his imagination. Stretching his arms, Leto looked out and down toward the broad grotto that had held the Guild Highliner. Among the scars of construction and support machinery, he could pick out the already sprouting skeleton of another massive hull, flash-welded together by teams of suboid workers. He watched the low-level inhabitants working with insect efficiency. A cargo platform drifted by, passing directly below the balcony as it made a gradual descent to the distant work area. Leto leaned over the railing and saw that the platform's surface was loaded with raw materials mined from the crust of the planet. On impulse, he climbed over the balcony rim, took a deep breath, and dropped 2 meters to land atop a pile of girders and plating destined for the Highliner construction site. He assumed he could find a way to get back up to the stalactite buildings using his bioscram card and his understanding of the city workings. A pilot underneath the hovering platform guided the lowering load. He didn't seem to notice or care about his unexpected passenger. Cool breezes riffled through Leto's hair as he descended toward the warmer surface. Thinking of ocean winds, he sucked in another deep breath. Here beneath the immense vault of the ceiling, he felt a freedom that reminded him of the seashore. With the thought came a pang of homesickness for the ocean breezes of Caladan, the noises of the village market, the booming laugh of his father, even the prim concern of his mother. He and Romber spent too much time confined within the buildings of Ix, and Leto often longed for fresh air and a cold wind on his face. Perhaps he would ask Romber to accompany him up to the surface again. There the two of them could wander around the wilderness and look up at the infinite sky. And Leto could stretch his muscles and feel real sunlight on his face, instead of the holographic illumination displayed on the cavern ceiling. While the Ixian prince was not Leto's equal as a fighter, neither was he the spoiled son so common among many great houses. He had his interests and loved collecting rocks and minerals. Romber had an easy, generous way about him, and an unflagging optimism, but that was not to be misinterpreted. Beneath the soft shell was a fierce determination and a desire to excel in every pursuit. In the gigantic manufacturing grotto, supports and suspensor jacks had been readied for the new Highliner already taking shape. Equipment and machinery stood waiting near where hollow blueprints shimmered in the air. Even with full resources and huge numbers of suboid workers, such a vessel required the better part of a standard year to construct. The cost of a Highliner was equivalent to the economic output of many solar systems. Thus, only Choam and the Guild could finance such massive projects, while House Vernius, as the manufacturer, reaped incredible profits.
The docile working class on Ix far outnumbered the administrators and the nobles. On the floor of the grotto, low archways and huts built into the solid rock provided entrances to a warren of living quarters. Leto had never visited the suboids himself, but Romber had assured him that the lower classes were well taken care of. Leto knew these crews labored around the clock to build each new ship. The suboids certainly worked hard for House Vernius. The cargo platform levitated downward to the rocky cavern floor, and teams of workers came forward to unload the heavy raw materials. Leto sprang down, landed on his hands and feet, then stood and brushed himself off. The strangely placid suboids had pale skin dusted with freckles. They looked at him with doe eyes and didn't ask any questions or object to his presence. They simply averted their gazes and went about their tasks. The way Kylea and Romber talked about them, Leto had imagined the suboids to be less than human, muscular troglodytes without minds, who simply labored and sweated. But the people around him could easily have passed for normals. Perhaps they weren't brilliant scientists or diplomats, but the working class didn't appear to be animals either. With his gray eyes open wide, Leto walked along the grotto floor, staying out of the way as he observed the highliner construction. Leto admired the sheer engineering and management of such an incredible job. In the heavier, dustier air on the ground, he smelled an acrid tang of laser welding and alloy fusing materials. The suboids followed a master plan, using step-by-step instructions like a hive organism. They concluded each increment of the huge task without being overwhelmed by the amount of work still in store for them. The suboids did not chatter, sing, or roughhouse. Behavior Leto had seen among the fishermen, farmers, and factory workers of Caladan. These pale-skinned laborers remained intent only on their tasks. He thought he imagined well-hidden resentment, a simmering anger beneath calm, pale faces. But he didn't feel afraid down here alone. Duke Paulus had always encouraged Leto to play with villager children, to go out on fishing boats, to mix with merchants and weavers in the marketplace. He had even spent a month working in the Pundi rice fields. "In order to understand how to rule a people," the old Duke had said, "you must first understand the people themselves." His mother had frowned upon such activities, of course, insisting that the son of a duke should not dirty his hands with the mud of rice paddies, or foul his clothes with the slime of a sea catch. "What good does it do for our son to know how to skin and gut a fish? He will be the ruler of a great house." But Paulus Atreides had his own way of insisting, and he made it clear that his wishes were law. And Leto had to admit that despite sore muscles, an aching back, and sunburned skin, those times of hard work had satisfied him in a way that grand banquets or receptions hosted in Castle Caladan could not. As a result, he thought he understood the common folk, how they felt, how hard they worked. Leto appreciated them for it, rather than scorning them. The old Duke had been proud of his son for comprehending that fundamental point. Now, as he walked among the suboids, Leto tried to understand them in the same way. Powerful glow globes hovered over the worksite, driving back shadows, maintaining a starkness in the air. The grotto was large enough that the construction sounds did not echo back, but reflected and faded into the distance. He saw one of the openings into the lower tunnels, and since no one had yet questioned his business there, Leto decided this would be a good opportunity to learn more about the suboid culture. Maybe he could discover things even Romber didn't know about his own world. When a crew of workers emerged from the archway, clad in service overalls, Leto slipped inside. He wandered into the tunnels and spiraled down. passing hollowed-out living compartments, identical and evenly spaced rooms that reminded him of the chambers in an insect hive. Occasionally, though, he spotted homey touches. Colorful fabrics or tapestries, a few drawings, images painted on the stone walls. He smelled cooking, heard low conversations, but no music, and not much laughter. He thought of his days spent studying and relaxing in the inverted skyscrapers overhead, with their polished floors, cerchrome and faceted crystal plaz windows, the soft beds and comfortable clothes, the fine foods. On Caladan, ordinary citizens could petition the Duke whenever they wished. Leto remembered when he and his father would walk in the marketplaces, talking to the merchants and craftsmen, allowing themselves to be seen and known as real people rather than as faceless rulers. He didn't think Dominic Vernius even noticed the differences between himself and his comrade Paulus. The hearty, bald earl gave all of his attention and enthusiasm to his family and the workers in his immediate vicinity, paying attention to overall industrial operations and business politics to keep the Ixian fortunes pouring in. But Dominic viewed the Suboids as resources. Yes, he cared for them well enough, just as he maintained his precious machinery. But Leto wondered if Romber and his family treated the Suboids as people. He'd already gone down many levels and felt the uncomfortable tightness of stale air. The tunnels ahead became darker and emptier. The quiet corridors led deeper into open rooms, common areas from which he heard voices, a rustling of bodies. He was about to turn back, knowing he had a full day ahead of him, studies and lectures about mechanical operations and industrial processes. Romber probably hadn't even eaten breakfast yet. Curious, Leto stopped at the archway to see many Suboids gathered in a common room. There were no seats or benches that he could see, and so all the people remained standing. He listened to the droning, curiously impassioned words of one Suboid, a short, muscular man at the front of the room. In the man's voice, and in the fire in his eyes, Leto detected emotions that he found peculiar, in view of what he had heard about the Suboids, that they were placid and undemanding. "We build the Highliners," he said, and his voice grew louder. "We manufacture the technological objects, yet we make none of the decisions. We do as we are commanded, even when we know those plans are wrong." The Suboids began to mutter and mumble. "Some of the new technologies go beyond what is forbidden by the Great Revolt. We are creating thinking machines. We don't need to understand the blueprints and designs because we know what they will do." Hesitating, Leto drew back into the shadows of the archway. He had walked enough among the common people that he usually wasn't afraid of them. But something strange was going on here. He wanted to run, yet needed to listen. "Since we are Suboids, we have no participation in profits from Ixian technology. We have simple lives and few ambitions. But we do have our religion. We read the Orange Catholic Bible and know in our hearts what is right." The Suboid speaker raised a massive, knuckled fist. "And we know that many of the things we've been building here on Ix are not right." The audience moved restlessly again, on the verge of being riled. Romber had insisted that this group had no ambitions, did not have the capacity for them. Here, though, Leto saw otherwise. The Suboid speaker narrowed his eyes and spoke ominously. "What are we going to do? Should we petition our masters and demand answers? Should we do more?" He swept his gaze over the gathered listeners. Then, suddenly, like two sharp flechettes, his eyes skewered Leto, eavesdropping in the archway shadows. "Who are you?" Leto stumbled backward, raising his hands.
I'm sorry, I got lost. I didn't mean anything by it. Normally he would know how to make himself welcome, but now his confusion raised his senses to a fever pitch. The worker audience spun about, and their eyes slowly lit with comprehension. They realized the implications of what the speaker had said and what Leto had overheard. "I'm really sorry," Leto said. "I meant no trespass." His heart pounded. Sweat sparkled on his brow, and he sensed extreme danger. Several suboids began to move toward him like automatons, picking up speed. Leto offered them his most congenial smile. "If you'd like, I can speak with Earl Vernius for you. Bring some of your grievances." The suboids closed in, and Leto bolted and ran. He rushed back through the low corridors, turning at random, ducking down passageways as the workers hurried, ineffectually pursuing and growling in anger. They flooded out, spreading into side corridors in their search for him, and Leto could not remember the way back to the open cavern. The fact that he got lost probably saved him. The suboids continued to block his retreat, attempting to intercept him in corridors that led to the surface. But Leto didn't know where he was going and took blind turns, sometimes hiding in empty alcoves, until finally he reached a small maintenance door that spilled out into the dusty air under the glaring lights of industrial glow-globes. Several suboids, seeing his silhouette in the doorway, shouted from deep below. But Leto raced out to an emergency lift tube. He swept his bioscram card through the reader and gained access to the upper levels. Shaking in the aftermath of a burned-out adrenaline rush, Leto couldn't believe what he had just heard, and didn't know what the suboids would have done had they caught him. He had been astonished enough to see their outrage and their reactions. Intellectually, he couldn't believe they would have killed him. Not the son of Duke Atreides, an honored guest of House Vernius. He had offered to help them, after all. But the suboids clearly held a deep potential for violence, a frightening darkness that they had managed to hide from their oblivious rulers above. Leto wondered with dread if perhaps there might be other enclaves of dissent, other groups with similarly charismatic speakers who could manage to tap into the low-level dissatisfaction of the vast worker population. As he rode up in the lift chamber, Leto looked down and saw the workers below, innocently acting out their roles, carrying out their daily routines. He knew he had to report what he had overheard, but would anyone believe him? He realized with a tightness in his stomach that he was learning far more about Ix than he had ever meant to know. Hope can be the greatest weapon of a downtrodden people, or the greatest enemy of those who are about to fail. We must remain aware of its advantages and its limitations. Lady Helena Atreides, Her Personal Journals. After weeks of aimless journeying, the cargo ship dropped out of the orbiting highliner and sped down toward the cloud-swirled atmosphere of Caladan. For Duncan Idaho, the end of his long ordeal seemed at hand. From his stowaway spot in the cluttered cargo bay, Duncan shifted a heavy box. Its metal corners grated across the deck plates, but he finally got the burden out of the way so he could remove the cover flange on a small window port. Leaning close to the protective plaz, Duncan stared down at the ocean-rich world. Finally, he began to believe. Caladan, my new home. Even from high orbit, Geedi Prime had looked dark and forbidding, like an infected sore.